Welcome to the Karmic Capitalist Podcast. I'm Eyas, and I'm on a mission to reconstruct capitalism.
Since I'm from Montana, where there's a phrase that the men are men and so are the women.
If you want your company to have purpose, how about starting small? Say, by reducing the emission of carbon into the environment by 500 million tons per annum. Yep, 500 million. That's what Jan Rippingale aims to do with Blue Banyan. And as if that's not enough ambition, she's helping the US Department of Energy define data standards for the whole energy industry. Not bad for a 30-person company. And all inspired by a vision that she had of her daughter. Enjoy this episode. Welcome to this episode of the Karmic Capitalist Conversation. And I am delighted today to have Jan Rippingale here with me. Hello, Jan.
Hello. How are you doing today? So glad to be here.
Good. Thank you. So as you know, these conversations are very much around companies that have purpose and or values at the core of how they work. And when you talk about purpose, purpose doesn't get much bigger than climate right now. And arguably, if you're talking about climate, it probably doesn't get much bigger than energy within climate. And I love this quote that I saw on Blue Banyan, which was, solar is not a spectator sport. If we're going to win on the big battles of the day, we need you engaged. It's all hands on deck. Which I think is a fitting intro to Jan. And Jan, tell us a little bit about Blue Banyan and what you do.
So Blue Banyan was started to help solar installers manage their businesses. When we looked at the solar industry and what was blocking getting more adoption, and we looked at this over 10 years ago, what we saw was that the hardware costs were plummeting, like they were 10% of what they had been a decade before. But the soft costs of running the businesses were actually the same or had gotten higher, and they were over twice what they are in Europe. You know, the US soft costs for running the business are, you know, twice the percent that they are in Europe.
And what are soft costs specifically, Jan? What is a soft cost?
Soft costs are not pretty much everything that's not hardware. So it ranges from taxes and permitting expenses and PMs and sales and overhead and accounting, all of the running your business
broad
side
range.
Of things. Exactly. And so we saw that our solar installers were construction people. They didn't know so much about software. And until they got these soft costs down, we wouldn't be able to deploy as much solar as we could if they weren't better organized. So we were specifically set up because putting in better business systems was what I could do to help address climate change. And I think that is the biggest risk across the next set of generation. The next generational crisis that we're facing, and I want to leave the world better for my kids than I found it. So this is what I can do to fix it. And so that's how we got started. And now we're actually starting to measure and seeing that we're, you know, at scale, this can actually make a dent in the problem. So it's very exciting.
Brilliant. And I want to come back to the business itself and how it works and the impact that it's having. But what was the road that got you to doing what you're doing now?
So the road was a little different than usual, probably. At 9, I decided I was going to be astronaut and then president. And John Glenn was my model. He was an astronaut and then he was a congressman. And I knew that I wanted to see the world as a whole and have all of those adventures. And then I wanted to bring all that good back in and make sure that everybody knew that women could be astronauts and women could be presidents. And that we could move forward in a strong, healthy, integrated way. And solar has always been part of being an astronaut. In fact, around in the 1990s, when I was going to college, they actually talked about terrestrial solar because they only used solar in outer space at the time. And they hadn't used it yet on Earth. So they had to differentiate. Yeah. They're only looking at terrestrial
Brilliant.
Solar. And from that time period of being interested in how the science and technology and then how it relates to policy has actually been a theme throughout my entire life. So Blue Banyan is about the software, science and technology, and I'm working with the Department of Energy's Orange Button Initiative for data standardization, which brings it into policy for how we're going to be able to get grid stability and reliability that we need with better information technology at the core. So that theme of technology and then bringing it into policy has actually always been in my life.
What did that trajectory look like sort of post-college for you? Work-wise, what happened professionally for you to get to starting Blue Vanyan?
It was actually an interesting journey because the goal that I set out was so outlandish that my teachers and parents were totally supportive of me. So I did repeat that this was my goal for decades and decades. And then I actually worked at NASA as an intern during college. And then I worked at Washington, D.C. in the Washington Internship for Students of Engineering. And John Glenn was one of the only congressmen in all of Congress, there are four at the time, who had any engineering or technical background, despite all of the technology-related decisions they were making. And John Glenn told me that at the time, Dan Quayle was in office, was running the National Space Council, and the plan was to send people to Mars without any commercialization in between, which wasn't a very good plan for space in general. And John Glenn told me that he didn't think he could prioritize spending money on NASA over the education needs that he saw that the country needed. And that was the moment that I realized that I hadn't hit my career goal at the right time. Because if John Glenn wasn't sure.
How old were you at the time?
I was 22. Okay. But if John Glenn wasn't sold on the value proposition of the space program at the time, then I didn't actually have much of a viable career. I had also just talked to the astronauts who had come off the Discovery mission that happened after the Challenger exploded, and they were excited to go up in space. It was a really wonderful thing. And one of the PhDs said, I just spent 7 years in diapers so that I could go up into space. There is no way I am going to wait around for the next mission. It was a super crude, but real, authentic take on what a life of an astronaut was. And so I determined that I could actually make a bigger impact by going into computer science. So I shifted, like, I still got my degree in chemical engineering. I still finished my schooling out. But I shifted into computer science and was decided that I was going to buy a flight into space and then I would go into politics after that. That was my adjusted plan after little coaching from John Glenn.
Just briefly, what was the trajectory between that decision and setting up your own company?
So I had intended to set up my own company regardless, but I knew that I didn't know enough about computer science, but I also knew I was kind of done with school. So I went and worked on an innovative project at the time with PepsiCo North America, and they had the first handheld devices, which I thought, you know, the first mobile tools, which I thought was super innovative and great. And so that's, I just went in and dove into how do you get technology adopted throughout a company with different cultures. And so these rough and tumble delivery guys became my computer users. You know, one of the big things was having buttons big enough that they actually clicked on the right one at the right time. Like, so I got literally a hands-on experience of what it takes to get technology adopted. And that was how I started on my career. I actually probably maybe lost the path for a little bit there. I went into corporate America and learned computer science and how this stuff worked for like a decade. And I was really interested in solar, and there I lived near Hopland, which is the Solar Living Institute where solar started in the United States. So I met some of the people who started it, and from there I met some people who were doing solar implementation work. I had shifted a little bit. I'd made good money as a consultant. I was doing fine, and I had my family basically. And I went through, you know, I've got three kids. And I just had my family and I was happy to live this regular kind of, you know, decent life and move through being a parent and a mom. And then when my daughter was just a few weeks old, I was nursing her, sitting and rocking in the chair. And I had something like a vision. I don't know if I fell asleep or if it was a vision or what exactly happened, but I saw that she was one of the people who was really fiercely opposed to bullying and the cruelty that she had encountered in the world in previous incarnations had deeply affected her. And she was bound and determined to prevent cruelty going forward in this life. Like I got kind of a vision of who she was.
And how old was she at the time?
She was about 3 weeks old.
3 weeks, okay, yeah.
So super, none of this was verbal. None of this was logical, left brain thinking. But I understood that she was fierce and noble, and I absolutely loved that about her, and that she didn't really know how to address this kind of bullying. And it didn't feel safe for me, for her to go out into the world that way. And I took from that I, in order to parent her properly, I needed to learn how to influence the world positively with skillful means so that it would actually impact the people who had been facing cruelty, and that she could actually engage, have an impact, and personally be safe while she did it. And that process was actually how Blue Banyan got started. The place that I knew how to affect the most was, you know, climate change. I really do think is going to be the source of the greatest cruelty that we are going to see in the next generation, next 20 years. And so addressing that effectively with my energy and technology background became my experiment for, can I develop into a person that can appropriately coach my daughter to achieve her mission effectively?
In some ways, that was about you effectively, or you say coaching, but also being a role model of, you know, this is what a, you know, what one can do with one's life. If one wants to take control, as well as I suspect an element of protection as well, because you're talking about the next generation and what they're going to face when they grow up. So you're almost providing protection and role modeling at the same time. Was it as instantaneous as that? Was it very much that you had the vision, you saw this, and pretty much it was like straight away, I need to get going and start up with the area that I'm going to impact? Did it take a while for it to percolate? How did that happen?
It probably took about 6 months to a year before I had all the pieces together in a way that made sense. My first reactions was just kind of being shocked and stunned. And then I got more proactive about what it is that I could do about it. And it probably took a little while to crystallize exactly how that was going to work out, because I needed to do some analysis and some real thinking about how the pieces fit together. Also, we didn't have the data and analysis available like we do now. Bill Gates, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, his most recent book, it absolutely fabulously outlines the reasoning for what it is that you need to do to avoid a climate disaster and where you can have an impact. When I started, it was just kind of this big thing and people were still fake science and we didn't have clean numbers. Like there's 51 billion tons of carbon and we need to get to zero by 2050. That's a very specific measurable goal. And none of that was available at the time. So it did take me a while to articulate what I could do and work through the math and the reasoning behind everything.
So it took that while, but it sounds like certainly the emotional switch had been made pretty instantaneously, that off the back of that, it was, I'm definitely going to do something. It's now a question of figuring out how to make that something happen. Is that fair to say?
Exactly. It was a pretty instantaneous, it was more of a conversion event than anything else. So I knew I was going to do something and I needed to figure out what I knew how to do and what I didn't know how to do and how I would learn the parts that I didn't know. Like one of my weaknesses was negotiation. And it has taken me a while to figure out how to address that in a way that I like. And ironically, the book Never Split the Difference, which is about hostage negotiation and has a title that sounds like a used car salesman negotiation.
Yeah, it's Chris Voss, isn't it?
Chris Voss, yeah. That style is the most relational, human, connection-based style of negotiating that I had ever heard of. And apparently it's more effective than the guys at Harvard, according to the book. So I have, needed to incorporate the skills, which is changing your fundamental language usage over time. But that was a key thing that I needed to build up. Mm-hmm. That Blue Banyan has been a vehicle for me to do, but wasn't immediately obvious to me which of my my shortcomings needed to get addressed first to be able to move forward.
And that's an interesting thing there, actually, just that shortcomings conversation, because it's interesting when most of us, there's very few of us who set up companies going in there fully confident that we can cover all our bases. What's interesting is some people are able to blag that and pretend that they can and don't do anything about it. Others are very visible with it and decide either that they're going to try and block that shortcoming themselves or find somebody who in the company will counterbalance that and make up for it in terms of how they scale up the model. It sounds like you took quite a sort of self-development route up front of, here are some gaps that I think I'm going to need to fill before I get this thing going. Is that fair to say?
Well, and just to be fair, I didn't think I needed to fill them before I got going. I just needed to fill them as I was going.
Absolutely. So, if we all wait till we're ready, nothing happens, right?
Exactly. So I was just aware of these as I went along of where my shortcomings were. The pieces that needed to fill in, there are some places where I just have people who think differently than I do around me. And that is really great. Like, I'm a big vision person and the details, they'll sort themselves out. But that's actually only true if you have somebody sorting them out
for you.
So I have people who are super detail oriented who are working with me, and I really value and appreciate them and let them know that on a regular basis. And that's never going to be my strong suit. And that is okay, because I don't need that in order to be the role model that my daughter needs. My daughter needs someone who can negotiate, someone who's not afraid of people who are trying to apply a lot of negative leverage, for instance, or doing these other kind of bullying activities. She needs to be able to respond to that. So I have to learn that skill. But getting good at managing all of the details as we go through every day of life, she may never learn that, and she can still be effective in her mission. So that really was the criteria that I used for where to build the skill in myself and where maybe I could buy the skill with other people's time.
But that's great, because most people don't have an intentional approach to that. You know, they may recognize there are some gaps, and it almost seems like happenstance with regards to A, if they do anything about filling those gaps, and B, what they actually do about filling the gaps. So I find that some company leaders come to the company with a purpose in mind. Others almost discover purpose as they're doing it, while even others are blissfully ignorant of what purpose could be or what role it may have to play in their company at all. But it isn't always right at the outset. Now, clearly it was for you. And the challenges I find are quite often different depending how people got there. I find that those who discover purpose as they go there quite often have set up a commercially strong company, and then find that something is missing and start to connect with what that something might be. And I'm painting here the what if it looks good picture, because as I say, sometimes there is just no comprehension of the role of purpose in companies. But what I find on the other side, and I'd be intrigued how it's worked out for you, is I find quite often people who come to companies with a purpose in mind at the outset are so purpose driven, they forget that a company needs to be commercially viable and survive and pay its staff, pay its founders, do all of those other things that, you know, commercial enterprises need to be doing in the system that we have. How did you fit that whole commercial perspective into the company?
Maybe I got really lucky, but I'm not entirely sure. I got a mentor came up to me earlier in my life, because I'd always been interested in doing good and bringing this back into the public policy and the public good. So I participated in Rotary and all the kind of regular community-oriented community service activities. And one of my mentors had a phrase. He said, first, you need to have fun, make money, and then do good. And it has to be in that order. This is Clive Smith. He was one of the people who founded AOL when they spun off from Commodore. And so he was doing really well and successful at the time and a big philanthropist. He was just like, you have to do it in this order. And it makes sense, because if you're not having fun, then you won't persist long enough to really make money at it. And the amount that you make money literally determines the scale of how much you can do good, how much good you can actually do.
Absolutely.
You have to make money and a lot of it in order to really do a lot of good. So that was a guiding principle and a mantra that we use on a regular basis internally for when we're going to make, when we have to make choices about what it is that we're doing. So having fun just means that the very first priority is that we get along with each other. We do actually have fun, of course, but mostly it has to do with anytime somebody's got bad feelings, that's the priority. Timelines can wait. Customers can wait. Whatever. If we're not feeling good about each other, this ain't working. So we have to do the have fun thing first, and that's the priority. Then if we need to choose between making money or doing good, like do we have a paying customer or is this a nice thing to add because it will give us grid stability 5 years from now? We're working through the paying customer now scenario, and we'll add the doing good piece, you know, as we honestly have space. And every business, we are scaling quickly. We are doubling right now from what we did in 2020. And there's still like cycles of real intensity, and then it'll relax a little bit, and then you'll have more intensity. If you use that cycling right, you will always have enough time to get your do-good side of life handled.
In terms of how that translates commercially for you, are your clients all in solar, or do you go broader than that?
We actually do have a broader base. Because of the NetSuite Foundation, we have probably about 40% of our customers are in retail doing e-commerce activities, and 50% are in solar, and then 10% are in solar related, but other not exactly installer businesses. The connection there, like, you know, ChargePoint doing electric vehicles or an adjacent, I guess. The reason that we went into the retail was that we actually knew people who were doing that, and it was part of how we would make money. And then the rest has just been referral based. We're not actually marketing that side of our business, but because we do good work, then we've got a large referral base. And what's nice about that is that retail gets really intense and excited about the time that the solar businesses are not paying any attention to you. So they, retail wants to work really hard through the summer, and then they kind of just want to execute, and they need a certain amount of attention, but they just execute between September and Christmas, right? That's, they're just execution. They don't want to build anything new.
Absolutely.
And solar installers do not want to talk to you during the summer. They are out installing every single day, but they'll be willing to talk to you in the fall when things kind of calm down a little bit. So those two sides of our business actually both have seasonality, and it complements each other really, really nicely.
Now, tell me honestly, was that intentional?
It wasn't. I'm just accepting the grace that flew, that came my way. Like that part was not intentional.
Yeah. I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. That's really far thinking.
Yeah, that was pure grace.
Okay, we'll say it was premonition based. Yeah, you probably had a hunch. So
yeah.
So Jen, on the impact side, so that's kind of where the commercial fits in. What is, can you dive a little bit into the detail of the kind of impact that the areas of impact and the scale of impact that you're either currently having or that you're hoping to have with the work that you guys do?
So we have recently been able to work with a client who has a large historical data set, and they imported all of the historical data, which most clients won't do because it's really messy. And from that, we were able to discern that we were saving, you know, 5 cents a watt in overhead costs. So what that means is the Department of Energy has identified that in residential solar, there's $1 per watt. They measure everything in per watt. So there's $1 per watt of soft costs that could be reduced. That is just extra. There's a certain level of taxes. There's a certain level of permitting and things that are not really going to get reduced. But there's $1 per watt that is just air management and all of this kind of thing that could actually come down by enhanced communication and technology. We are, on overhead wages alone, reducing it by 5 cents a watt. So that translates to about, if you're doing 100 jobs a month, which is a solid, healthy business, but the largest ones are doing up to 3,000 jobs a month. But if you're doing 100 jobs a month, that translates to about $40,000 a job, because the average house right now is 8 kilowatts, because people want to set themselves up for EVs for their electronic charging. So we're saving approximately $40,000 a month in overhead expenses, which is more than the software costs by a lot. So it has an immediate impact, positive impact for the solar installers that we're building into. So we've got 5 cents a watt with our current capabilities, And then we're adding layers of this with the Department of Energy so that we're improving how permitting is done and how you know which permitting agency you need to go to. And we're improving how you get the products and the product certifications. And we're improving how you report back on the energy production that you're doing and how much battery storage you have so that eventually we could actually have grid stability information and coordinate all of these disparate distributed systems. So we're building all of this in for the long-term impact. It is going to continue to reduce soft costs as we go through. But even now at 5 cents a watt, that is enough of an improvement that we can get, we can reduce the carbon footprint by the half of a billion tons, 0.5 billion tons per year, roughly corresponds with a 5 cents per watt reduction in the residential carbon. So the half of a billion tons per year is the threshold that Bill Gates put out there saying that they only invest in technologies that can reach this threshold of impact if deployed at scale. So solar success deployed at scale is currently would meet that threshold. And then we're layering on top these other tools that will increase that over the next several years.
So the impact opportunity is truly enormous, but I'm aware that you're also engaged at a broader scale yourself within the industry, specifically around sort of data stands and so on. Can you just quickly touch on what that work is about?
Yes. So that has been a key element in growing our network for Blue Banyan, is that it's a largely volunteer effort. We're like corporate sponsors of the Department of Energy's Orange Button Initiative. And it is formally run by SunSpec, which is an industry not-for-profit organization. So part of what I did is just could see that the data standardization was key for us to be able to deploy anything at scale and continue to talk to each other effectively, especially because we are distributing power. We are moving away, just like everything had like mainframes kind of power. And then you went back into personal computers and everybody had their own computer. And then you kind of went into dumb laptops where everybody just talks to the internet. And then you go out to apps and iPhones where they've got more powerful computers than were the supercomputers at the time. So this cycle of centralizing power and decentralizing power is expected to go through its pendulum swings. But the US went too far on the centralizing power. And when you do that, you've got single points of failure, as we saw in Texas, which is really brutal. And all of these kind of difficulties with maintaining that centralization. But then as you decentralize, how do you be coordinated if you actually want grid stability? If you've got a battery system and your neighbor needs to run their oxygen tank, would you be willing to share your battery power so that they can continue to stay alive in their house that's next door to yours? Most people would probably say yes. And in order to effectively do that, we need to be able to coordinate and distribute this power. So setting up these data standards and working with the Department of Energy is a big part of the mega trends going on with power generation being centralized or decentralized. And managing that decentralization just helps us be better neighbors. It helps us be nice to each other. It gives us freedom and control over our own destiny, since electricity is actually essential in modern life to be a contributing member of society. So all of these things together, I knew that we needed to work forward in that not for profit. So the time that we spend on that, the Blue Banyan spends on that, is just free. And with that, we've got great connections and networking, and I get to talk to insightful people that normally I wouldn't be very difficult to get access to. So it's been really great. And I recommend that everyone tithe a little bit of their time to do some good and volunteer at a bigger level than your particular business may immediately need, because it will benefit the industry as a whole.
Yeah. And I think that's a great tip, especially for purpose-driven companies, because very often, although they're serving a goal that's external, their method of implementation tends to be fairly internal. And I think you're right. If you look outside of your own, just outside of your own company, in terms of the what you can be shaping at a broader industrial or national scale, then you're both scaling your impact and, as it happens, probably creating commercial opportunity as you go along. So no, that's a great tip. That's a great tip. And Jan, I'm intrigued also. So we've talked a lot about the solar side, obviously, because we are talking about Blue Banyan. But there are a couple of things that you mentioned. First of all, going right back to the trigger point for you, and that trigger happening with a very, very vivid vision that you had with your daughter. You also mentioned previously about, you know, proving that a woman could do a couple of things in industry. I'm intrigued on how gender plays out in, or has played out for you. Clearly, you're in an industry that is male dominated. Doesn't seem to have slowed you down or stopped you in any way, which is fantastic. But I'm wondering how much of that plays in your mind, how much of the I am playing a role model as a female, proving that actually females can do this, or is it just happening, just through momentum?
Well, so I have the advantage. I grew up in Montana. I'm actually a fourth generation Montanan. And in Montana, Jeanette Rankin was elected to Congress before women had the right to vote. So the first woman was elected to Congress before women had the right to vote. She went into Congress saying that she would not vote for war, and she did not twice, both for World War I and World War II.
Brilliant.
She is heroic and fierce and incredible. So her role model influenced my life. And since I'm from Montana, where there's a phrase that the men are men and so are the women. And what that means is not that women have to be masculine, but women are very strong and they're able to just say, this is what we're going to do.
That could be open to so many interpretations.
Totally good. But my intention is just that the women are equally strong in determining their futures and fate. So I don't ask for permission to do any of the things that we're going to do. I'm not waiting around for other people to agree that my ideas about how to influence climate change or to affect the energy industry are good ones. I am the center of gravity moving this initiative forward as I see fit. And people come along with the pull of the gravity when they recognize that this is how it works. And so I'm not asking permission. I'm not waiting for anybody. I'm not waiting for anybody else to validate that this is a good idea or this is important or that climate change is real or that solar is going to make a difference. We had all that figured out years ago. And now everyone's like, of course, that's obvious. But it was obvious 5 years ago, too. But we didn't need to wait for everybody else to clue in. So I would recommend that people just be your own, be the center of gravity and move forward the way that you've decided to do it. Then gender is not an issue. Because you're the one innovating, you're the one moving things forward, you're the one driving the conversation. And someone's got a gender issue, they probably also have FOMO, and the FOMO is going to outweigh any gender bias for sure. Because no one wants to miss out on the opportunity.
Yeah.
If you're generating that, you know, people will follow you. The gender part doesn't actually make any difference whatsoever. Other than for me personally, as a vision, being a mother with my daughter, that absolutely affected me and maybe gave me a more intense ferocity than anything else. I did actually have a conversation with my daughter while walking on the beach, and he said something about how women were like light and fairy and kind of flowery. And I was like, well, that's interesting. And who are the fiercest of all beings on the planet? And it's like, I've got Mother Tiger and Mother Bear, Mama Bear. Those are my two kind of images
for where
ferocity comes from. It's not a male characteristic. It's a female characteristic. And the men adopt it when they clue into the energy of utter devotion. But that utter devotion is exactly the opposite of this fierce protectiveness. And so it's absolutely gender coherent to be fiercely protective and to move the world forward in ways that will create the right generation, a better generation for the kids. Like, that is completely, completely good to be in a leadership role that way. And it feels great. And in my day-to-day life, I actually don't think about my gender one way or the other.
That's a fantastic insight, though. I love that. When you talk about what is the most fierce animal, it's a mother protecting her cubs, right? And to translate that into protecting the future, that's a magnificent insight. And you're right. You know, if you're serious about that, then you've got to take the fierce model. And where does that come from? That comes from the mother with her cubs. Jan, how's it playing out with regards to other, perhaps younger or women earlier on in their careers than you? Do you interact much? Do you? Because arguably, well, no argument about it. You clearly are a role model, I think, for women who are thinking about where to take their leadership capabilities and how to make those things happen. Are you at all involved in sort of in either circles or people who are interested in that?
I do have some women that I'm mentoring, and they're in their 20s typically, going through and starting some businesses and getting going with their identity in their life, doing everything from, you know, pottery to novel writing. So very different areas than mine specifically. And that mentoring is a whole lot of the same kind of mentoring that I got, you know, typically from men, although there were some female mentors in my life, like my mother was also a fiercely awesome woman. So there, I am doing that role modeling, but mostly it's just being present in the areas.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. It's just being present, speaking at conferences, just doing what I need to do for my life and for Blue Banyan as a business naturally engages that. So I'm not consciously or separately advancing any particular agenda around my gender. I'm just presuming, again, that it'll be the center of gravity and people will make of it what they will.
Yeah. And again, I think it's, you know, there are multiple approaches, right? Yeah. One can take the explicit, you know, I'm going to talk to people in an underrepresented group and intentionally see what I can do about it. But there's also an approach of just, well, I'm just going to go out there and prove it. And you can look and see that it ain't impossible. There are ways to do it. And those ways are ways that are open to all of us. Although I fully accept that, sometimes for some of us, the path may be harder than it is for others. So,
yes. And I am coming from a place of privilege, some of which just comes from being born in Montana, right?
Yeah. Jan, I've really enjoyed this. There's been so many different perspectives. I love, you know, especially the big vision that you guys have and the ability to impact it in terms of not just the scale of the potential impact, but the fact that a relatively small organization is able to do that. I mean, we're not talking here an IBM or an Oracle. I mean, how big are you guys? How big is Blue Banyan at the moment?
We've got about 30 people right now.
Okay.
So it's a relatively small organization, and the need is so great and our solution is so much better than our competition that we are having that level of impact.
You're having an outsized impact. And I always love that, where, you know, we were the same. I love being in the organization that is the punching way, way above its weight class. And I think there's no doubt that you guys are. So Jan, thank you so much for making the time to talk to me today, to talk to me about what Blue Banyan does, about its purpose, about how you got there, and about the impact that it's having. If people want to find you or Blue Banyan, how would they go about doing that?
So bluebanyan.com has got a contact us page. There's also info@bluebanyan.com that will cycle people through to exactly the right place in the organization to connect. Those are actually the most direct ways to hook up to everybody, since spelling my last name is too hard.
You think spelling your last name is hard? So,
yeah, exactly.
Welcome to my world. Brilliant. Jan, thank you so much for making the time. It's been a real pleasure. Could have gone on forever, but really appreciate you taking the time to do it.
So thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and I really appreciate your vision.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of The Karmic Capitalist. Please subscribe if you want to hear more about companies building values and purpose into the heart of business. If you're more of a reader, I do send out 2-minute reads on leading business for profit and purpose, which you can find at beyondthequarter.com/bitesize. Finally, if you'd like to work with me directly, contact me through LinkedIn. There's nobody else with my name there. Thanks for joining me on this episode of The Karmic Capitalist. Please rate and subscribe if you want to hear more about companies doing good business and the nitty-gritty of how they got there. I'd also love to have a conversation with you if you lead a small to medium-sized business with 10 to 100 employees and values are important to you. If that's you, come join me and a handful of other CEOs in one of my weekly thought-provoking conversations about how to make your strategy and purpose happen. We discuss and workshop practicalities, processes, strategies, and the human nuances of scaling up, giving you more time to do strategic things and even what those strategic things might be. Find details at btq.link/makestrategyreal.